Yo.
Can you hear me?
You listening to Hashtag W-A-W. What a week.
What a week. Week.
Eita, welcome to another episode of Wow, What a Week. We have a bumper episode this week. June is obviously Youth Month in South Africa. Globally, it is also Mental Health Awareness for Men Month. So we figured we're going to bring in a gent who is kitleva. But he's an intellectual. He is a professor. He is outspoken. He often speaks truth to power. And he has a beautiful mind. He's joining us next. Now, you know I'm all about smart moves, but this one got my attention. Absa's latest innovative and fun way to save for any goal is called Savings Coach. You set your goal and automate your savings contribution, from a business move to a new bike, whatever you're dreaming up. And it helps you get there step by step. You stay in control, but it keeps you focused. It's not just another savings tool. It's like having a plan that vibes with you. All on the Absa banking app. Try it out and start stacking the wins. Absa Savings Coach. Absa is an authorized FSP and a registered credit provider. Terms and conditions apply.
This is
Wow!
What a week.
What a week. Celebrity guest.
Celebrity guest.
Jumping straight into today's episode. Not only are we going to talk about institutions of higher learning, we're going to talk about the soul within those institutions. We're joined by a man who's never been afraid to speak truth to power, Professor Boitumelo Ben Senukwane, theologian, public thinker, and someone who calls for a radical return to ethics, community, and African-centered healing. Please welcome the Prof. Prof.
Good morning.
Welcome. As a theologian, would it be off that we didn't start this with a prayer?
No, it depends on how you define prayer.
Error.
You know, because in my worldview, prayer, it's supposed to form part of our routine.
Yes, sir.
Not only as in the Western form, but as part of our living.
Yes, sir.
How you participate in economics, how you participate in politics, how you participate in societal matters.
Sir.
Prayer must be part of it.
Absolutely.
Inherently. It shouldn't be a moment or an accident of some sort or an event. Mm. It must be part of that routine.
We mustn't even feel that we prayed.
No. It shouldn't be.
Fused in. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Now, good morning, Tato and Prof and the followers and the viewers. You know, when people have always said I am being radical and too much of an Africanist, I always say, wait until you meet Professor Senukwane from the University of South Africa.
Yes.
And you will understand that I'm actually moderate when it comes to decolonizing of the African mind, as well as issues of, you know, religion and culture and spirituality, you know, African spirituality that has been left behind. But ironically, Tato and Prof, we have decided to be with Prof on the Youth Month, as you correctly said in the opening remarks, and Youth Month as well as the world or the global, you know, a celebration or recognition of mental illness, particularly towards men.
Mm.
And all this happens when South Africa has been faced with quite a number of things regarding gender-based violence, you know, youth abuse, feminism, and men generally struggling with mental health issues that I personally think are being undermined. But Prof, you've written a lot and extensively regarding these issues. For me, we know it's where we start. As Tato said, normally people say begin with a prayer. For me, it starts with the Africanness of it. Where do we come from as African people? To can arrive at a point where we are scattered all over. Amongst other religions, Africans are the only people on earth who have ditched their spiritual and religions and beliefs and adopted foreign ones. And I think that's where some of our challenges are.
What are your thoughts, Prof, on that?
Look, like I said, the idea of life in Africa is not segmented. Mm. You don't speak, like I said, as an example on prayer. You can't speak of politics without religion. You can't speak of religion without economics or the society. The theologian, Manas Buthelezi, wrote that this approach on doing theology must always be holistic, meaning that you can't disintegrate life.
Yes.
And I think that's where, as Africans, most of us, we find ourselves trapped into wanting to separate. It is more in the political circles you will find people emphasizing politics in the current South African context, forgetting that what sponsored colonialism and apartheid was religion.
Absolutely.
Religion, of course, one will argue that they move from wherever they were because of economics. But for them to design their theory, ideology, philosophy, theology plays a critical component. In fact, many of the apartheid leaders, they would have been trained as theologians.
Yes.
And successful theologians, for that matter, to a point that they justified them coming from Europe as being sent by God to dominate Africans and to take over our land. And once you miss that, you know, there is a saying, as it's one mutla unsuaga mutla.
Yes.
Once you forget that basic principle, then you will want to underestimate the role that religion played in us building the concept of apartheid and even colonialism.
Yeah, before you carry on, just for those that don't understand that saying basically says to remove a thorn in your foot, you must use another thorn.
Yes. Correct. So that's more or less my view about how we... But you'll know also, as early as Kasem and others, they were trained by missionary schools and so on.
Yeah. I wanted to say on that one, it's just that history tends to be distorted a lot. But when the colonialists arrive and they put religion, particularly Christianity, and you know, in front of us, but even the Arabs came and did that in some parts of Northwest East Africa. Ironically, they also took the supposed to have been African leaders and liberation movement founders and leaders. And you just mentioned Pixie Isaka Kasem as one of an example. Even, you know, most of them became reverends. Most of our forefathers or political liberation movement founders in Africa, they were sent to missionary schools abroad to go and study theology or religion. And they came back, in my opinion, I would say, more humble, more easy toned down kind of a situation, because then they were driven by religion, they were driven by theology or Christianity, which was one of the, you know, language, religion,
sure,
were the biggest weapons of the colonialists in the continent. I don't know if you'd agree with me, Tato, that was another problem of the colonizers and another truth.
But we're here now with a professor from a UNISA. How do we then go back to source? How do we control alt delete in a way that we can say to young people, there is another way, that's where we come from, whether it's within a UNISA context or context at home? How do we bring it back to source?
Look, the reality of the matter is that let's first start with the introduction of education in South Africa, 1658. The first school was introduced for two reasons. First was to teach Dutch. That's the first reason. Secondly, was for Christian catechism or Christian instruction.
Yes.
Those were the two fundamental reasons why the first school was built or in South Africa, in Amersfoort. So if you take that as the basis of education, you'll understand why we find ourselves trapped into that mode that religion is fundamental in our education.
Sure.
But secondly, the question of language. In fact, you know, when we are speaking about decolonization, that's an important concept today, philosophical, ideological concept. You know, I would ask, you know, can we have equivalent concepts in our languages? We don't need to be linguistic or language experts. Why don't you use Mukubetu to want to speak about decolonization? Why must it be used English in reverse?
In the reversal, yeah.
Yes. Without considering that there are similar concepts in our worldview, in trying to speak about ourselves, explain our life in different segments as Africa. So I think for me, we need to first go into our culture, our traditions, and language is fundamental in doing that. Our own African traditional religion is fundamental. The understanding of the running of Lekgotla is very fundamental because the questions surrounding Lebollo, they are fundamental in how we want to understand our ways as African, without necessarily being stuck in the past. But that will open the door for the future for us.
You know what I'd love to see? Since the Department of Education are not in a hurry to decolonize how our children are taught, I'd love to see traditional healers, I mean, not traditional healers, traditional leaders, saying, in my village, on a Saturday, we gather the youth and we re-educate them about where they're from and what they're about. Because I think we all have that responsibility. We can't just look to the Department of Education to say, let's decolonize. But our traditional leaders, they are captured by religion and we're diluting our ways of life. And it gets worse because now we think English is the end all and be all.
Well, I wouldn't even say let us separate it and remove it away from the education program.
Sure.
Why take it on a Saturday? Because once we do that, it will be the interest of those who are interested to attend to. If we want to dissect and you know, revisit the education system, let those in traditional homesteads, in cultural homesteads, the chiefs and the so-called traditional leaders, let them talk to the communities because they've got influence in communities, they've got influence in schools, they can still influence the education system. Introduce what you are saying, Thato. Introduce it as part of the curriculum during the school days, the Monday to Friday school hours. Even if it's an hour a week as a start, to say we are going to introduce our culture and tradition, as for example, if people are in Umtata in the Eastern Cape, this issue of the boys are going to Entebbe and coming back, Lebollo ka Setswana, and all those things. Let them be introduced as part of the education system. Because once our people and youth are more informed, then they will be welcome, they'll be more receptive to this process. And let me make an example of the June 16, 1976, you know, uprising, the voice of the Lanyans, who are, if it's 49 years now. So if you were 20 years old in June 16, like majority were between the age of 17 and 22, you know, that's the majority of the youth. They are now in their late 60s, early 70s. And look at the children of people who are 69 or 70 today. Where are the kids of those people? They're speaking English. They're in English-speaking schools. So the purpose or the intended purpose of June 16, which many people think it was a battle for Africans only. No, that was not the only issue. The issue was those youth, the Tsietsi Mashinis and Khotsose Akgolos and many others, led by Stephen Bantu Biko. They were talking about, let us be taught. Let the medium of instruction be our mother tongues. Setswana, isiXhosa, isiZulu, isiPedi, and isiNdebele, and so forth, and many others. And actually, when you look at it, that purpose has been defeated. You know, that's my perception. It was not only to get away, do away with Africans. Let us be taught mathematics, science, and everything else in our mother tongues. And we actually have been defeated in that battle because English took over from Africans. And that's where we are today. So for me, I think it will take more than just the chiefs and the leaders of the community. The Department of Education, as you said, they're dragging behind. But us as parents, as families, and, you know, I don't know what is the program of higher learning institutions in this instance. Despite the ministry, the politicians, what are the institutions saying?
Look, institutions have got their programs, of course, informed by the framework of the Department of Education and policies of government. But of course, because institutions will naturally become autonomous and independent. They then craft, of course, informed by that framework, what they think will work for them individually. Mm. And I think based on that, there are also gaps. Because UNISA will do this, for an example, University of Pretoria will do this, Stellenbosch will do this, and you won't get uniformity in that regard. And I agree, you can't really reduce our language to, for an example, the Department of Linguistics or Language Department. It must be part of the curricula in its entirety, totally so. For example, if it must apply in economics, it must apply in engineering.
Sure.
It must apply in energy. Because once the trap of wanting to reduce it to a specific department, or in this regard, to the chief of a community, then you remove it from life itself.
You know, that's why I often look at the Afrikaner community and wish we were as passionate about our languages and about our ways of life as they are. Because often we judge them for doing it, thinking they want to separate themselves from us. But in the bigger scheme of things, we need to fight for our languages just as feverishly as they do.
It's what you call it. They are preserving their culture, tradition, and language. And we all know, without the language, we are a lost nation. We cannot even communicate amongst ourselves. If we want to plot something, whether it's a good plot, whether it's an economic plot, or whether we want to design a vehicle by black engineers in South Africa, We are so much stuck in English that... that's the word I wanted is... because we have failed. You know, we can't... And I learned it from the Afrikaners, actually. Yes. Coincidentally, when I started working for government, I used to tell people...
Yeah.
You know, Prof, when I became a very young diplomat, what was the best form of language we could use abroad as South Africans? It was Afrikaans. Because when we spoke English, our host will hear us. Yeah. When we try to speak Sizulu or Setswana, our white counterparts will not understand us. So Afrikaans became our secret language, except when you were in the Netherlands. It was a different ball game. But when you were stationed in any other country. So the language issue is very crucial and it's very important. And I think, if we can start instilling that in our youth, it will help. We are a lost generation. We have missed the mark, but we still have the background. And we can be actually the buffer between our kids and their future to say, it does not mean when you speak Setswana, Kampo, Sindebele, or Xitsonga, therefore you are not intelligent. Therefore you cannot fit in the society or the international community.
You know, that's one of the reasons I was very upset seeing Papa Penny being forced in front of a parliamentary committee to speak in English. And I don't know if it's between him and the party that this could have been fixed. He did not have to speak in English. So now we're focusing on the fact that his English was bad and not what
the
he
content.
Was saying. And why is it with a strong?
I think the Prof is one of the things you're probably experiencing it at seminars and events of I've attended one at UNICEF, I've addressed one day, communication one. People tend to express themselves better in their own mother tongue or language or sign language, whatever form of language. And we know that Papa Penny is, you are using Papa Penny as one of the examples. He is one of the activists who have been in the forefront of traditional and cultural music.
Yes.
And now it's neglected. If you'd have allowed that person to raise the question, Kastonga, give him a brief politically, but allow him to address Parliament, Kastonga, he would have actually made much more deeper and better point than reading from a script. I don't know.
In fact, if you had to ask the people, the constituency that voted for him, would be people who speak our indigenous language.
Exactly.
So there is really no need for him to be forced to speak English. In fact, it is part of the program that we should be advancing as universities, that we must go as far as people to write assignments in their indigenous languages, to do their dissertations and theses in using their indigenous languages. One person asked, then who is going to mark perspective who are going to be examiners.
Examiners, yes.
Because we are lacking experts in our traditional languages.
Yes.
But I don't think that should be a question. My view would be that we need to start implementing that and then struggle.
Yes.
Finding those who are relevant. But I doubt that we have a shortage. It's just a matter of assuming that we don't have enough. And by virtue of assuming that, we make wrong decisions.
So, bothata keng, is it the political will to make it happen? Because often it's always the same, we don't have budget. But I figure if you have enough of a political will, you will find the budget.
Look, I serve in a committee called the Geographical Names Committee, Gauteng Geographical Names Committee.
Yes, sir.
Part of our responsibility is to name and rename geographical features, streets and others, you know, the issue of Winnie Mandela streets and you know, things like that. So I sit in such a committee in Gauteng. You go, sit there, people would have submitted constituencies, communities, individuals, coming with certain suggestions approved by the committee. Now it must go back whether being it the municipality road or the provincial road or the national road, there is no implementation in that end, using budget as the constraint. You'll have made the decision to say, look, we don't think that this geographical feature speaks or represents this particular constituency or community.
Yes.
You agree, approved everywhere, followed any process, but you are told about the budget. It tells you that there is no political will. Because if there was political will, it was going to be possible. Even the question of not having enough of experts in our indigenous languages, it shouldn't arise because we should have become deliberate, put more money into our project of indigenous languages.
Absolutely.
We should be experts. You know, now we are sitting here forced to speak as if we can't hear one another. And we can hear one another clearly when we speak Setswana. But we are forced to conform. Because perhaps the market dictates, and we know what is the market. There are two languages of the market. Trading language in other spaces would be Afrikaans. In other spaces, it's English. So I don't know why we don't learn from the Chinese, why we don't learn from Russians, why we don't learn from Arab countries. They are successful and they are proud with their language.
And if you want to deal with them, you get a translator. It's as simple as that. A high school friend of mine, she has a master's in Mandarin because she knew she could make a lot of money being a translator, knowing that China would be moving in. She made this decision 20 years ago already.
She was
that,
so smart.
That there will be a lot of activity on the continent. So she has a master's in Mandarin.
We have been accused before that we have turned this platform into a Botswana boys platform. Now it's going to be worse after this weekend. But you know, talking of that, I'm thinking as you are talking, if my memory serves me well, sometimes last year, if not 2023, there was somebody who wrote his thesis, whether it was a master or doctorate, in isiXhosa. And in South Africa, I think it was on the Eastern Cape. He wrote completely the whole thesis in isiXhosa. And I was just thinking, if people have this assumption that there will be no markers or observers or assessors, where do they come from? Because if one of the most highly decorated people in education decided to write his thesis, and I think that's not just a simple one like language. I think it was an engineering or something like that. But you know what I will love, that's my dream to see, is for institutions like the University of South Africa that are operating in the global arena. Because UNISA is not only the biggest university in South Africa by numbers of students, it operates in the global arena as well. They are best positioned to can influence this and come back to South Africa to the fellow students and the panelists and everybody who's involved in the exchange to say, our counterparts, other institutions in other countries, be it in the Arab land, in Asia, or in the Americas. You can look at Latin America. Look at countries in Latin America, what they've done. To say they are doing it. Can't we start somewhere? And I understand the budget constraints. And I don't think it's budget proof. I've been in government long enough to know if they form committees like the committee you belong to or you mentioned, it means there was a plan. And when you plan, part of planning, you put the budget in. I think it's political willingness and people wanting to sway this to the favor of political figures. And as the naming of streets and towns and everything against political figures, it doesn't have to be a politician. And for me, I've been lamenting about this for a long time. That it doesn't have, yes, we must recognize our fallen heroes and founding members of liberation movement, Winnie Mandela, Robert Sobukwe, Chris Hani, and many others, the sameness of this word. However, we could still align some of naming of what you call geographical and cultural streets and buildings to actually, let's say, animals in Africa. And I understand what I'm saying. We could even be naming. This week I had an argument. Actually, it was not an argument. I had people visiting me on Sunday, on Father's Day. And we had even a debate, us as Zulu, so to speaking people, that what is Lengau? What is a cheetah, leopard, and tiger? In Setswana or in Setswana. We had a debate for men, grown-up men. And now, the only way I went out of it is because I said to them, there's no tigers in Africa, so don't take tiger.
So we wouldn't have a word.
We wouldn't have a word for tiger. That was the only way they were like, okay, he's right. But I was not cleverer. It was an escape route for me. And that shows how much we don't want to start. We have to start somewhere. I don't, that's my view, Prof.
No, you do get, of course, such. But, of course, what we've learned is that because language adapts, you have borrowed words that you can still use. It's not disallowed. English has done the same. You know that most English language would either stem from the Greco-Roman world, where they borrow Greek or Roman words. In other instances, even Hebrew words to try to form English. So it's nothing new. We can also do that as Africans.
I remember the research paper you speak about.
Yes.
Xhosa. And you know, a part of my heart broke to a certain extent because it shouldn't have been a big deal that there's a research paper that said Xhosa. It should be common cause. And again, and this is not me holding a candle for the Afrikaans community. Instead of always attacking how they do things, we could learn so much from the Afrikaans University, community. So instead of calling them out on starting an Afrikaans-only university, we should be saying, why is there a university about Setswana, where everything is taught in Setswana? Why is there no Venda University, where everything is taught in Sivenda? So instead of saying, why are they doing this, they're isolating themselves and shutting us out, why are we not saying, let's learn from it and do it?
And we had an opportunity.
I would give an arm and a leg for my children to go to a Setswana university.
I mean, look, in the modern-day new democratic South Africa, we have had at least two new universities. And if you look at them strategically, they are from two provinces that I may say they were mainly isolated. And
yes,
like,
they were left
the Northern Cape and Mpumalanga. We should have taken that opportunity, actually, to introduce even the SAN language in that university in the Northern Cape to be one, a language of medium of instruction to some of the courses or subjects, whatever they call them, or modules. And we missed that opportunity. We should have started somewhere, especially when it's a brand new university that never existed before. But I think, as Prof says, even if there's no political willingness, let people like him or any opposition rise above the occasion. And guy politicians, by the way, are not always all educated and informed. They have to be fed from somewhere.
Sure.
And it is our academic people who actually are also strategically positioned, because politicians believe a lot in people who are certificated, graduate, and academic. That's why they take a lot of professors and senior lecturers as advisors to ministers and politicians.
Sure.
They still have hope and believe in them. So I think that our academia and people in the field of education,
sure,
they've got a very pivotal role to play.
But then you must also acknowledge at the same time that we don't operate outside of this bigger system called the state.
Yes.
That
there's still that umbrella.
Yeah.
You've got language policy.
Yeah.
Oh, that will have to be regulated. But even internally, council members in different institutions, they come there, have different views and might not be proactive or in implementing certain things that you think as academics should be. Because at the end of the day, councils of universities make decisions. Senate of universities make decisions. Then you can assume, for an example, that because a senate or a council of a university or even a government, parliament, is constituted by, in terms of demographics, by majority of black people, then you assume that they shall go in there, approve our indigenous languages as the mode of teaching. It doesn't work like that. You know, the saying that Reluilwe ke mang, and then arise on why if majority of people in parliament are blacks, in council, in the senate of universities are blacks, why can't we just wake up? But it's not as easy as that. It's difficult.
I mean, you're at UNISA, yes. And you guys have graduations all the time. But your gowns are very, very Eurocentric. Likewise with all other universities. And there's nothing about your graduation gowns that says, these are African graduates, that takes pride in we are in Africa, for argument's sake. I mean, how are you guys navigating that? Because I know it's conversations that are ongoing at institutions of higher learning.
Before you answer, but in responding, just also inform me and our viewers, if that is regulated, the pura pura, that's called that thing that my mother used to say, why did it have to be black? We dress like we're going to a funeral, you know. So is it regulated? Is it internally in an institution or is it a Department of National Higher Education? Just for information.
No, it is institutional. It's not really regulated by the Department of Education. It is institutional. So every university has a leverage in changing the designs and coming with something new. It's just that, you know, the saying by Albert Mem, who says that the colonizer lives twice. He lives for himself and lives inside the mind of the colonized.
Yes.
So we find ourselves trapped into thinking that you can't be a graduate without that gown.
That gown.
That gown defines what it means to be a graduate. In fact, at UNISA, we are busy now discussing the redesigning of academic gowns. It's not a simple discussion. It's a process, you know, on how can we do it without offending. And the question is, why should we even be worried of offending?
Who are we offending?
That's the question. Why should you be worried? Because other people have been comfortable. They did not care who they are offending.
Yes.
But our point of departure is that we are offending. We might be seen to be anti-academic program, agenda. And that shouldn't be arising. But it is the reality of what you are dealing with. With people who want to argue on the basis that for us to be defined as an academic institution, we must conform to Western norms and values. And that's the reality that you are dealing with. Up until such a time that we liberate ourselves as blacks, as Africans, unfortunately, we are where we are. And it doesn't only apply to, like I said, to institutions of higher learning. It applies with what is happening in parliament. Our lawmakers themselves are still trapped. The laws that they are using, go check there. Most of them are colonial apartheid laws, legislatures, legislation that you find there. They are using the prescripts of colonialism, of apartheid, and they do that without thinking twice because the colonizers are least twice.
And they are lawmakers, so they're in a position to amend a lot of those laws.
But, you know, I always lament about this whole process. Actually, 2 weeks ago, we had a conversation with Tato here about the problem I have with the judiciary or the judicial system in the country. The dress code of black and white in some countries like Kenya, they still wear the wig, and the issue that most of our laws, whether legal people like it or not, most of the laws in this country, more than 70% of the laws in this country are pre-1994. We still have the Criminal Procedure Act of the 1970s. And it is also, it's not only the acts, legislation, it is also the methodology, the formats, the way law papers are written, court papers are written in the country. They are still written and conducting themselves. You mentioned Parliament, Prof. You know this thing called decorum. The only thing that Africans brought in that parliament is more black faces, which are now more than 60%. And sometimes you will see members of political parties, particularly black people, although Helen Zille always sometimes dresses African, you know, so-called cloth and material. It's the change of clothing. The formality is a little bit out. The majority of people in parliament now wear what they want to wear. But it does not translate into their thinking. And so if wearing the so-called Madiba shirt or traditional African shirts, was moving into changing the mind of the people in parliament, it would have been very far. And I still see there are people in parliament who still address parliament in their own language. They come prepared and they address parliament. Whether the translator is ready or not, it's immaterial. The fact that we could do it, Tato, the fact that we could, Prof, pass laws in this country to have 12 official languages. Somebody said there should be 13 and 14. Because now we have added on the 11, we have added the sign language. Mm. And now somebody said, but we should have also added the SEN language. We should have added the so-called township language informally, because it's so used so much that it has actually a saying in this community. Mm. And if we could do that with languages, why can't we do that with the content of the education system of the country? And that's my challenge.
Absolutely. Now, Prof, given your work on ethical frameworks and decolonial responsibility, how do we hold leaders in institutions accountable in a way that aligns with Ubuntu, for argument's sake, rather than a political rivalry or leanings?
Look, and I think, what we are trying to resolve, it's more like you want to resolve something. They say that the more you want to change things, the more things remain the same.
Yes.
And I think that's what we are trying to escape. But we always come back to the same problem.
Mm.
The question of politics and Ubuntu, let's go to the question. Assuming that there is Ubuntu and there is this politics, one will assume that Ubuntu is part of the African worldview and conception.
Mm.
And in the African worldview, we shouldn't assume that there are no politics.
Sure.
Because politics, in short, it talks about the affairs of the city, the running of the city, or governing or governance, which one will assume that Ubuntu itself is inherently speaking to governance.
Mm.
Whether you speak, for an example, Prof. Mokgobe Ramos, as a philosopher, will speak of humanness and others, but Ubuntu can't only be limited to that. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, using theology, trying to explain Ubuntu, others will want to limit it only to conflict resolution. Mm. But it's beyond that. It can't be that. It defines the worldview of Africans, how we do things from politics, economics, religion, and as a society. So I just wanted first to clarify that, to say we shouldn't want to put this one against this one,
yes,
because the other one must inherently mean that.
Mm.
But trying to answer it within the context. Of course, governance in Africa means something. And in decision-making, we know that we always try to emphasize consensus in decision-making.
Mm.
But of course, even conflict resolution is done differently. In a context where you have elders will always advise, because the saying that so you always have to consult with those who have worked before you, because you don't necessarily have to reinvent everything. Others, people have passed through what you are going through. Therefore, by consulting them, you avoid reinvention. So it becomes waste of resources to reinvent, while others have got solution to that. So my view is that in the context of higher education, there has been people who have been there. They might have ate also. It doesn't mean that it's a successful story. They might have ate, but they might equally have achieved some of the same. We need to consult them in how we want to build institution of Ireland,
yes,
from a conceptual point of view, but also from a practical point of view, because they will know better what needs to happen in us managing institution of Ireland. Some of the problems that we find in institution of Ireland is that competition that you might be referring to without really talking about, because rivalry stems out of competition of the space.
Mm.
You you as individuals, as intellectuals. And in fact, Prof. Ramose argues that we shouldn't be having a concept of university, because he argues that all universities should be called pluriversities.
Sure.
Because one acknowledges that you come together with different theories, ideas, sure, philosophies, and you bring them under one roof. Mm. Then naturally it creates this cocktail of some sort.
A plurality of some sort.
But yes, the competition itself, is it amongst intellectuals and academics in an institution, or is there a competition of different institutions? Is it UNISA versus WITS, Stellenbosch versus RAU, or whatever? What do you call RAU Joburg these days?
Yes.
Is it that kind? What happened to that body of higher learning that actually they used to call it a committee of university principals? I don't know what it is called these days, where it will oversee all these institutions to think from one program. Where is the rivalry, the competition? Is it inside the institution? Professor Senokwane versus Professor Nkadime in the same institution having different ideologies. What causes that?
Look, there is a body called Universities South Africa,
okay,
where all the heads of different universities meet, but it's a structure. But we also know that there's a Council for Higher Education. So there are these different entities that are meant to bring universities together for different programs.
Okay.
You know, even the SAQA itself on programs and so on and so forth. So we have such. But the reality of the matter is that academics, researchers, intellectuals, natural, they've got opinions.
Mm-hmm.
So internally, that's why you have a Senate, because a Senate is a body where all these professors sit, academics sit, okay, try to come with decisions. But the unfortunate part is it's that it becomes, whether through consensus or a democratic body, where decisions are made and the majority makes a decision.
That's where the problem is.
And you naturally become defeated. And sometimes we are not mature to agree that you were defeated through processes, whether it's through consensus or whether it's democratic process, but you become defeated. And it shouldn't be negative.
Mm.
It should be that, look, this one advanced a better idea,
yes,
or persuaded people sitting with me in the same meeting better than... It doesn't mean you are wrong sometimes.
Yes.
It has been proven over and over again that sometimes, even if you are a minority or an individual in a meeting, future sometimes exonerate you.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean that, you know, you should move away from a collective. Of course, ideas, innovations are sometimes born by individuals, but it is equally the same. The truth, where majority also can have possess the truth.
So would you say some of the challenges of being an intellectual at a university, being an academic, requires the maturity to stay the course in terms of what you believe, but also being mature enough to understand that other ideas might gather more momentum than yours? It doesn't mean your idea was bad. Like you're saying, it just means Botsang got a bigger constituency at that moment.
Mm.
And when in 20 years we'll say, oh yes, he did say that. But you need the maturity though to
look, in Africa, let me now go home to theology.
Yes.
You'll have in Africa black theologians in South Africa.
Mm.
And you'll have African theologians. Both are blacks.
Mm.
But their concentration is different.
Mm.
Others wanted to pursue the struggle from a point of view of economics and politics. African theologians wanted to pursue it from cultural, traditional point of view.
Mm.
Whether they are right or wrong is a different matter, but the concentration is different. So I'm making that as an example to say it doesn't mean history has proven over and over that in all the spaces you will have different people in different eras,
yes,
having different ideas on how to solve a problem for their society.
I think the problem also becomes having too much educated people in one room. Everybody wants their weight to be out. But again, you mentioned earlier on, Prof, that there's democratic process, there's institutional process that are being followed in making these decisions. You know, this brings me back to one of the discussions we've had several times regarding how SADC, the Southern African Development Community, operates. And I think, again, For me, this is where democracy is failing us as Africans. If you're going to have such an important institutions, you have mentioned three bodies that government have created, and they operate in a democratic process. So the majority voice will be the one that's adopted.
Yes.
And that's what I like in law. In law, they've got also, they take into consideration, and they always note the minority decision. If you've got, you know, the eight judges presiding over a case and two are disagreeing, I started actually seeing that more and more under the retired Justice Mokgweng Mokgweng. You remember the incident where he insisted that please read also the minority judge. And we have realized, actually, we are confirming what Justice Mokgweng had said years back. It is important to keep in mind what the minority had said, even if the majority prevails. And I said, but again, SADC, unlike the East African community, and I think the East African community, which is in this instance Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, Uganda, and others, they adopted something which I think it was influenced by their Lekgotla. I think it was influenced by their tradition. That parliament there, one, they have a parliament in that region, and it does not work by consensus only and majority only. It looks at the needs of each of the particular
countries. What's in the best interest?
What is the best interest of that region? In SADC, we have draft documents. Any, whether it's culture, whether it's roads, whether it's language, whether it's currency, that have been sitting with the SADC secretariat for over 20 years because there's 15 member states in SADC. 15 must agree for those policies to come into effect. Where on earth will you find 15 hard-headed people agreeing? It is not going to happen.
Isn't one of the reasons why it's easier for the Eastern African community to collaborate and cooperate, they're more homogeneous generally in that eastern part of the continent than we are in the SADC region?
Yes.
So, for instance, I mean, I remember there was a time, I was not born then, but Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland shared a university.
Yes.
What stops, whether it's SADC or Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland, South Africa,
SACU member states,
having a common university with common academic goals that would best serve the region? What stops the OAU from having a Pan-African university in Ethiopia, where we have academics teaching and thinking at that level? Instead, we continue to have these silos operating and not necessarily in the best interest of Africans at an African level. I don't know your thoughts on that, Prof.
One would have thought that, you know that in Addis, there's African AU Academy.
Yes.
One would have thought that they would have used that as to create what you are proposing. But for some reason, we are in a constant competition as Africans, and that defeats the purpose. And I liked what you said to say, maybe we are defeated, and we don't want to admit. And
are you saying colonialism won then?
There's neo-colonialism. There's new methods. Anyhow, I don't know who the two of you talked about. The colonizer reinvents themselves. I think that's you, Prof. They come back.
They're like a virus.
Yes, they come back. They what we call mutate. They keep on...
Mutation.
Mutation. Yeah. And we as Africans, we did not adapt to the movements of the former colonizers. They come with new strategies. For example, the youth of today, and I will emphasize more on the youth because it's a youth month or youth week or what. The youth of today, none of us, we can tell our kids who are in their 20s that 1976, 1961, 1912, 1949 program of action, they're not going to listen to that. They're going to listen to, I want to do this, I want to be a DJ, I want to be a soccer player, I want to travel abroad, and I don't want to have kids. And then imagine if your son says, I don't want to have kids. For us as African men, it becomes a taboo. Why don't my son want kids?
Where is he? Yo, Tato, you're having kids, my dog.
So you see now, the first question, Tato, you're having kids, my boy, because he wants to be a grandfather. He wants the Sikwane clan to grow. We must talk the language that our kids understand. We are not going after 49 years tell kids who were born after 1976 or during those years of what they should be looking at the moment. We should give them today's solution. Today's solution is how do they compete with those Afrikaner kids who are having a university in Centurion that is teaching them the Afrikaner culture, Afrikaner languages, history, and everything else. We are not doing that. So I think us moving forward, we should counter what the neo-colonialists are doing. And it's very basic. We don't need a government to do that because we know there's no political will. We need ourselves. We need our families. We need to influence the institutions. I'm glad that we are having this conversation started with a professor, an academic, to say they are continuing to feed us what the colonialists prepared as the basis of education. That's why most of the students today, they are actually graduating to be workers, to be employees. For who? For industrialists and landowners. Who are they? They are products of colonialism. It's white people.
I'm happy you're saying that. But unfortunately, you'll always be a lone voice. I'll tell you why. Your average parent are so busy just trying to put bread on the table. If there's a parent-teacher meeting, they don't have time because I'm busy hustling.
Yeah,
and it's easy for us to say parents must be involved. Parents must be involved. For that average parent, just to get to my child's school is extra taxi fee or fare that I don't have. So how do I get involved? I'll give you an example. When we found a school for Thato and Wandi, Thabiso was always at the parent meeting, and she was always the only black woman who speaks up and says, why are the black staff only cleaners in your school? She was that parent. But not enough of us are doing that the thing will change is the problem.
You know, David Roth, that recently sparked a debate about the reductions of number of universities in the country and to privatize that.
Yes.
And saying that perhaps 10% should be the ones who are exposed to university environment. And I wrote in response, to say...
So what is he proposing happens to the 90%?
It must be privatized. Others must go for skills training.
Okay.
But remember, I argue that he's speaking from the base of the apartheid resolution.
Yes.
To say, for example, my argument is that you have more or less about 7% whites in the country. So he has exceptions in his 10% for either two categories. One will be that he thinks that white will then increase in the future. Then it will grow by 3%. Then it becomes a total of 10%. Or he has a view that the clever blacks should be accommodated in the 10%. Yes. Then they constitute 10% as long as they'll be able to sustain the agenda,
yes.
As long as, the African child is locked out there. But that can't be the case. We need to invest in the education of the African child. And young people, must take that serious and understand that it is not only about preparing them for labor or business. It is also about the way of life.
Yes.
They need to understand where they come from. In fact, the exclusion of social sciences now and human sciences and in high spaces of education, it is equally a problem.
Is it excluded or it's diminishing?
It's diminishing. There is exclusion in other spaces.
Really?
Others, it diminishes because... you'll be told that's why language will not be taken serious. That's why history will not be emphasized. That's why culture is not emphasized. And you'll be told about without really undermining the project of preparing the country economically. It can be at the expense of excluding social and human sciences.
But that is why certain subjects ought to be compulsory. I believe history must be compulsory, and not just history, a decolonized history teaching to our children. Otherwise, they will know nothing about what we should not be repeating And it almost feels like, let's keep them ignorant of where they come from so that they can repeat the mistakes of the past. Why else is history not compulsory?
You know, Tato, I will go back to something that I've said many times and people will undermine. You probably are tired of hearing
your mother tongue must be a compulsory subject for you at your school.
And I'm saying it should not only be a compulsory subject where if you fail it, you know what they need to do? First language be Setswana for me.
Yes.
Then I choose a second language. And if I fail Setswana, if I pass all the other five subjects, if I fail Setswana, I can't progress. Mm. You see, it's the abuse of the mother tongue by doing that, actually.
Yeah.
To say, you are only good at speaking your mother tongue. Yes, I must be damn good at speaking my mother tongue, without doubt. Mm. But if it's going to be used as a tool to say that he can't speak his mother tongue,
yeah,
and then it can hold you back. But again, gentlemen, you know, I've always said this. We can scream, we can tumble, we can write, philosophize, and put money in everything. Lack of land ownership by African people is part of the problem. Mm. And the fact that we do not have land that we own to can practice our traditional, whether it's rituals, whether it's customary practices or spiritual practices, the fact that our kids, whether it's in the Northwest, Northern Cape, Mpumalanga, or Limpopo, have to go and gather somewhere on cold winter and months and long December months to go through the initiation school process. Mm. And I said, and they have to gather some in a land owned by some chief, because the majority of the people in the Eastern Cape, they don't own the land, or in the Northwest, the land belongs to few individuals. And it's a problem.
Or to the tribal authority.
Or to the tribal authority. Mm. How on earth are we supposed to practice our traditional customs and spirituality when you don't have land to can do that? Actually, if we start slaughtering in your own yard that you don't own, actually. Mm. You know, if you live in the cities, you don't own that land. The municipality is in charge. You can't even slaughter the way you wish or you want in your yard because you are breaking some municipal bylaws, you are cruel to animals and all those things. For me, that's a challenge. The fact that we don't own the land. And once Africans do not pass, you look at kids today who are calling mabele ating bogobe bo brown, a brown porridge. That already is wrong on its own.
Yeah, but that's our fault, as their parents.
Because we were planting grass and flowers and roses in our gardens instead of planting mabele in our rooftops.
Because at some stage, as a parent to that child, you've got to take responsibility for what they know and what they don't know. We can't delegate everything to government and institutions of higher learning. The base should be, that base is your responsibility.
The socialization starts
exactly
first in the family, beyond the family, of course, within the community. And I think what we underestimate is the role that churches play also in socialization.
Yes. Mm.
But then we should also, I always tell people that before a child is baptized,
yes.
But I think sometimes we miss that important
majority of component. People actually don't bother.
Don't bother. So then it creates, and I wanted to speak to what you were talking about. For you to understand the importance or to grasp the importance of the land, it goes back to history. But even beyond history, your language speaks a lot about the land. If you know the Botswana national anthem, Lefatshe.
Fatshelo la rona.
You go to Botswana one, Lefatshe. Laboraron. Mm. If you listen to the lyrics, put aside Mangope and his doctrine.
The land is important. It's an integral part of the
le fatshe la khomo le mabele bo swa jwa rona ka bo sa khutli.
Yes.
If you were able to grasp that language, link it to history, it defines who we are. In fact, I wanted to speak, you know, in my doctoral dissertation, I struggled to break certain concepts of what it means to be Lekgowa. And it took me long. For me to have unlocked it, I had to use both the tools of language and the tools of history to understand what it means.
Yes.
So I'm just making that as an example to say language and history, used together, that combination is able to unlock meaning and the importance of certain things.
Well, for those who didn't know, Lekhoa, we've got followers and fans from all over the world. So Lekhoa is actually a white person. We can call it an European or a settler or a Caucasian. And Kastwana ke Lekhoa. No, I just wanted to simplify that.
Do you want to talk about the origins of the word Lekhoa?
No. You know, it's a... What I argued in my dissertation was to say, because I struggled, because I was using Solplaki as the basis of some of the argument that I was writing on. So now I struggled to find in the writing of Solplaki, specifically the native. He was mad. Whenever he was referring to people of African descent, you call them natives, Africans, you know. Of course, those will be the concepts.
Yes.
But then when he refers to Caucasian, he will now use different concepts. So I wanted to understand why is he, you know, he's not like he's refusing to write, but you can argue that he's refusing to write. Because he makes that clear distinction. Say natives, Africans, I don't know whether black he uses, but he used specific concepts
natives, for
us. And when it comes to Caucasian, uses different one. Then I asked myself, but why is that the case? You know, I was struggling because I wanted to write about the concept of Ubuntu.
Sure.
But I wanted to understand first where does the concept stems from. You know, where there's a verb. Now I struggled also with a noun. And now I had to break the word Lekhoa into two. But for me to have succeeded to doing that is to use both history and language.
Okay.
Now you will know that Khoa, it's a verb. To spit.
Yes.
You know, and in other instances, to vomit. Now, I struggle to understand what does it mean. But only history, if you go to 1652, they arrive using the sea.
Yes. And it's
moving.
It spat them out.
That's the experience.
Yes.
That's my interpretation.
Yes.
Okay.
So, le, I don't know, you call it, is it a prefix or, le. Before, the one that you use before, is it an adverb that you use before the verb?
Before the verb.
As an indicator of something. So it indicates an action.
Exactly. That's my little understanding.
That's what
the sea has vomited.
That's what I concluded. Because
it's
the historical experiences, now they used language to describe or define their experience. So that's my conclusion. But now, you say, look, in the Basotho, Botswana, Bapedi context, this is what it means. But why now Abelung?
Abelung, yeah. The Nguni language.
Now it's different. But now you deal with an experience of the coastals and the interior.
Yes.
You then learn out of history the Voortrekker. The trekkers are moving as a what? As a group.
As a group, yes.
They are experienced not moving as individuals, but as this group moving into the inland.
In the mainland.
Abelung, belonging to a group. So they are defined through events or certain actions. So that's how I came to that conclusion. But then I had to use the tools of history and language to unlock that. So it was not easy.
There we are in a lecture room.
And this is you as an academic.
Yes.
Can you imagine now if, like we're saying, history, language were the basis of everything we do for our children, how much further they could go in understanding who they are, where they come from, where they're going?
Especially in terms of, in UNISA, we've got what we call 10 catalytic niche areas, includes, energy and others, feminism, Bosadi, and womanist approach theories. If you were to use history and language, we can unlock a lot of things.
Yes.
Because most of them are locked into history, the space of history and language. Unfortunately, we can't unlock them because we find ourselves trapped
in the language of the other.
Of the other.
Yes.
And now trying to find meaning for ourselves. Mm. But if we had access to our history and our own languages, we can unlock many things.
Sure.
I'm doing it as a theologian, as a, from the humanist point of view. But imagine a natural scientist using the tools of history and language. They can unlock a lot of things.
So much more.
So much more.
We are running out of time, Prof. And, you know, you're from UNISA, like we said earlier on, and because you deal with the amount of people that you do, technology becomes another way that you guys can reach people and we reach you. And in your work, you write about the alienation of modern African subject. Many students are battling to navigate, for instance, digital portals, feeling isolated and unsupported. How do you think UNISA and institutions such as yourselves can reimagine tech as a bridge and not as a barrier?
Look, we must, of course, embrace technology. We must not be having the phobia of technology. In fact, we are where we are today because of the input of the creative of technology.
Mm.
But the question that we must always ask is, what is our own contribution as Africans?
Mm.
Do we have any contribution? Can we bring anything into the table? I believe yes.
Mm.
We need to, like you said, use our own culture, what we've learned from our traditions in trying to improve. Sometimes it's not only about improvement or transformation.
Mm.
You will know that the risk of transformation, always I argue as a concept, transformation assumes that there is a base, there is a foundation. You must move from something already provided by someone.
Mm.
And I don't think that's my view about how we need to participate in the space. Of course, in other instances, you can transform. But in other instances, we need to create.
To be innovative.
We must be innovative. We must even change as Africans so that we are able to participate as any other. Because the risk of only transforming is that we will forever be trapped into defining based on the premises or the foundations of others. So tech must embrace us as Africans, our worldview and how we think things.
I think my challenge with tech, and it's I don't want to be old school and feel like I don't want to transform because I use technology a lot where I'm capable of, it's when it is being used as a tool by neo-colonizers to can actually continue to brainwash and direct the mind of the African child. You look at television became one of the first innovations we were exposed to in the mid-70s. You know, these youngsters don't know that television became only available in South Africa, I think, 1977-78. My challenge is when those, you know, technological advancements and availabilities are so Eurocentric. Mm-hmm. And I will use two examples. Look at how social media, and I'm talking modern day, social media is used so much, we fail to turn it around to can even teach the history and the culture and the language, like what we've been talking about. It actually, if you look at TikTok and Facebook and whatever, it's Eurocentric. It's still the westernized thing. And majority of our youth have access to it and use it more than us. But the content is very wrong. You look at, and I want to use something that people may undermine as an example. In the week that we are in, we saw how the two countries, Iran and Israel, were using missiles to can shoot and attack each other. And you know what it brought into my mind? The one of the greatest generals of war, King Shaka, of the Zulu nation, when he actually redesigned the spear that they use in order to attack the colonials during the war with the British. You know, said at the beginning, people wouldn't know. Now I look at the Scud missile or whatever ballistic missile used by Iran that you can shoot from a certain point to another point. That was the initial spear that the Zulu nation used to can throw into the colonialists. Shaka realized this is not working because they are using guns and advancing you know, in groups. Therefore, what we need to do, we need to break this beer because we can't throw anyway. It's not effective. Let's break this beer and make it shortened so that we can engage into immediate combat. Mm. I may be talking military tactics. So, but I'm saying if we can do that with technology, that it should be the first point of entry for our kids who don't want to sit and listen to old men and women talking, you know, in Setswana or isiXhosa, who are having the palm of their hand technology. If we could do what China, some people say it's indoctrination, it's controlling people, it's not freedom of speech, when a country politically determines what goes in there and what will go into our society. Mm. The fact that we are a liberal country, so-called democracy, people have freedom of speech and rights, we allow everything.
Sometimes it's to your own detriment.
It's to our own detriment when you look at it. We allow everything. If we were using this technology for them to be exposed to things that will advance their cause, I can tell you most of our kids, they spend more money, more time on social media for things that do not build them than for things that could have built them mentally, emotionally, you know, and even academically.
Just to piggyback on your example of, in fact, now I was watching Shaka Ilembe the weekend because I enjoy it for obvious reasons. As much as it's a different ethnic group.
What, for history or for Nomzamo? Because I watch for Nomzamo.
No, not really for that.
Okay.
No. No, she's beautiful. We can't deny that. But for example, of course, there's a lot of technology in military. Mm. And most technologies were invented because of military. Mm. If now you take an example of a long spear versus a short spear, the reason advanced by Shaka is that you can't throw it to an elephant from a distance. Mm. Don't kill it. Now you need a shorter version of it. But that what informs him is his worldview, because he knows an elephant. He knows the space between himself and the elephant, and based on that, it informs him what he needs to desire.
Exactly.
But if then you want to use the worldview of the other to make technology, to advance technology, then you miss the point because it must first start. Of course, we all know that technology innovation is always informed by trying to think something out there. But imagine if you think something out there without your own worldview experiences. Because your own worldview and experiences tells you about limitations. And it's only when you want to think beyond the limitations, based on your experiences, you might want to develop something new.
Yes.
So that's more my take in that space.
Absolutely. We are out of time, gentlemen. And I know Prof needs to get back to UNISA. I don't know if you want to...
Well, it's fine. I'm happy. Look, this kind of discussion we'll need more, you know, engagement and so forth. I had thought we'd have had time to speak about earlier on your opening remarks. You mentioned that globally there's a celebration on mental health, you know, means actually to be specific, the challenges, the burdens. You know, that when I looked at that topic, as you put it in there, one of the things that came is actually what I've been going through myself, what has been happening in the country regarding men's mental health. And historically, or religiously, or biblically, a man is a provider. Those are the kind of things that have put us in a situation. And people must not think I'm sitting here and protecting men's conduct and behavior that is bad or seem to be bad. But I'm thinking of a situation where if we were aware of what men, and I want to talk about African men in this country, are going through on daily basis, whether it's social ills, whether it's economic ills, or simply a mental illnesses. You know, years back I used to joke, I suffer from, for example, insomnia. You don't know how many times I've been saying to my medical friends and knowledgeable people, I still do not know why insomnia is not being listed as one of the serious mental health illnesses. Because like last night, whether it was anxiety of being with you guys today, or whether I was tired or going through my own thing, I could not sleep. I could not at all. I woke up, I went to bed at 11 p.m. I woke up four times in the middle of the night. And all the time I check the phone that I'm not getting late. Let me take another 2 hours. Then I wake up. It's insomnia. It's a mental illness. Because once you have gone through that, you are dysfunctional for most part of the day. And you know, there's so many things, the economic issues that people are undermining. And then what we rush to do as a nation and experts is to put people on drugs, is to put people on antidepressants, anti-anxiety tablets, and so without looking at the root cause of the pressures that men go through. You know, I'm saying this after a week of the so-called Father's Day. And I realized I was sitting with 22 guys on the so-called Father's Day. And I realized that and it was by design that it was men only, fathers, adult people, not youth. There was the youngest person there was about 35. The rest, the oldest was 59. And 22 of us were sitting for hours and discussing what men go through, whether as fathers, whether as husbands, whether as individuals. And in my view, it's a lot.
No, you know, I was with my daughter in the morning to drop her. So some guy was just passing where they were not supposed to be passing. So I say, but what is this person doing? Then my daughter says, hey, see, I go wish up. So, you know, in real essence, men see, I go wish up. And I don't think we, because of the cultural burden that we have, and the stigmatization that we undergo as men within our different societies and communities, we then attempt to go to Munnakimku.
Sure.
And that becomes a problem.
Yep.
But also the stigmatization of mental health in general. It's a problem in our communities. And I think we have a long way to go as Africans in trying to redefine mental health in space of, especially for men, because we do a lot. Some of us, we are trapped in certain things as men. Our behavior can't be condoned. It's unbecoming. And when you trace the root problem, it's because of some of the things that we are hiding. We don't talk a lot because most of men, we don't like talking.
Sure. How do you think faith-based spaces can become more welcoming and a safe space for men to open up about whether it's depression or what they're going through, or, you know, if we are Goisha, as a theologian yourself, how do we adjust faith-based spaces for men to feel safe, that I can go there, get read? So for instance, our church has a men's WhatsApp group where we share, we talk, we meet once a month, just Majita, to talk about our stuff. And there's a lot of stuff.
Look, I think we must all acknowledge that whether it's in the faith-based space or communal or political, it's always safe that you must have people that you first establish trust with.
Sure.
Whether it's your pastor, whether it's your sangoma, it's always important to establish faith and trust because, you know, you can be open to everyone. You might find solution by narrating your experiences with other people. But so long as people are not trustworthy, they are not loyal, they are not truthful, you might set yourself to another problem, a new problem. But it's always to one, you know, I always tell people that in my space, I'll always have one or two or three of friends that I can speak comfortably about my challenges, because you will know that as men, there are certain challenges that you know that this one, if I can say, it might make or break me, because if it were to go out there, it might be the beginning and the end of yourself.
Sure.
As a man. And now you have to deal with new problems of trying to redefine yourself. So I'm just saying, even in such spaces, you also have to be calculated, because not everyone out there, even in faith-based communities, are safe. But I can tell you that the beauty about faith-based communities is that at least you are able to talk. That's the first instance. Of course, within the parameters of what I've just said now, you're able to talk. People are able to advise you, share their experience in return. But it's always problematic in those spaces if you were to have a person or a partner that you share with, but they are not willing to share
willing to
in return, because our spaces are toxic and political.
people, you share your experiences with them tomorrow day, use them against in other spaces. But the beauty about the church, if you find people that they can share with you, they are able to keep your secret safe, unless you are the one who says you can take it out there, because you must be, remain the one who's in charge of your own store. Not anyone or everyone should tell your story.
You know, you do gentlemen speak like you are talking to me. I think the challenge of experience and in engaging is, you mentioned two things, the trust part as well as the support structure. And we were brought up to think that the support structure must come from the family. And I'm over and over as an adult realizing that the support structure, the main pillar of when we come in middle-aged adult, you know, 40 and up, it actually not necessarily doesn't come from the family. The family is there. When you are doing good there, they are very happy. They will want you to succeed and do good. But I have found an experience that the support structure that you get and the people you can confide to and talk comfortably with are not within the immediate family. You mentioned an example of a partner. Unfortunately, I don't have a partner that I can confide to. Maybe I'm on the safe side to can do that. But the issue of faith-based, you know, groupings, or whether it's political groupings, or even at work relation or neighborly, you know, the community you live in, not where you grew up, you live in. I find it very hard to be trusting, and it could be a mental problem. Until I once had a CEO who said to me, I'm such a good person. The only bad thing about me is that I am not trusting easily.
Sure.
And I said to him, I'm actually aware of that, and I'm using that as a firewall, as a defense mechanism, because I'm scared of what human beings will do when they know the little. I believe in the old school of art of war. The lesser the people know about you, the better.
The less naked I am in front of
you. Exactly. Or even worse, mislead people. And I do that a lot. I not mislead by lying, but when people think I am, in this instance, the other way out to succeed, it's an art of war strategy to say, this is the situation about me. Then you can sift out those who think they can use your status or your situation against you. But look, for me, this issue of mental health in our communities and ourselves, I think it needs more time, more engagement. I think men, it's not only about talking, it's what happens after you talk.
Yeah, sure.
Because people will look for results. People will say, no, men must talk, men must come out, men must be open. You mentioned very important things, why men are not open and not doing that, because that gets used against you in future. But I think it needs much more of a voluntary kind of a situation. You know, I've been accused by quite a number of people to say I'm anti-religion, which I'm not, but I'm also very secretive, and I don't trust people with that. And I think most guys go through that. And my fear is I will end up instilling that to my sons. And I don't want my kids to be like me to a greater extent.
Yeah, what do they call it? Intergenerational transmission of trauma.
Exactly.
I think is what they call it. How do we have more black young men feel less voiceless and invisible than they do right now?
Look, of course, we must acknowledge that it is difficult to be a man for a boy in this current context, because we are paying for the sins of patriarchy,
sure,
where we've oppressed women, abused women for many years, and I'm not only talking historically. We've inherited a system that told us this is what it means to be a boy, to a point that you must be physical. We've inherited the bad side of excluding women in decision-making, either in political circles, in the churches, in economic business circles. It's what we have inherited. In fact, even in terms of when one drafts the will on who takes over, unless, you have a soft spot for your daughter, but you even think that, hey, if my daughter goes to this family, they will take my
will.
But you are informed by patriarchy. It's not you speaking. Because if you love your child, it doesn't matter, even the boy one. So it's natural. But because we come from this worldview that is anti-women, now in our attempt to try to redress, to change things, to rectify things. Mm. We are equally trapped now in this corner of not wanting to say things because you might offend, not wanting to do things because you might do wrong things to women. But I think our approach is that we must acknowledge that we have this baggage from history. We are not perfect beings as men in South Africa, in the continent, or elsewhere in the world. But it's a struggle that we must acknowledge that it continues. The only best thing that we need to do is to at least try to teach our boys to love, to care for girls, for women, and it must start in the house. Mm. I always tell my boy to say, if you don't love your sister, no man should love your sister. If your sister can't experience that love from me and you, how does she define loving to other men out there? Because what we do to her, she can't compare it to anyone. Mm. It must start there. Otherwise, the love that she will learn out there, it might be toxic, it might be wrong kind of love. So it's very important that we must try in our little spaces that we teach our children, our boy children, to become better people than us, because maybe we have failed. And in our failure, it doesn't mean that we don't try. We are struggling with this demon from the past that inherently is there. So it's nothing that we can just wake up and think. Yeah. Even if you are conscious, sometimes subconsciously, you act, you know, informed by this demon of that past called patriarchy.
This is my house. I'm the final decision maker. Those kind of thinking.
But also be clear in your last will and testament about who gets what. So, for instance, if it's properties that you have, make sure that the properties belong to your children or the family trust. Mm-hmm. And that if my daughter gets married, these cannot be touched by the person marrying my daughter. There are so many ways you can actually fix this problem.
But
often we don't want to think that far.
Yeah. Even when the boy gets married, as Prof said, actually, you know, thinking of it, men get more troubled in marriages than women. When you look at men tend to lose more, maybe historically and culturally for customary marriages based in rural areas. Maybe women lost because men moved to cities and they had to hit some of the assets or the monies they made. But if you look at modern day marriages, Majita go out there running. Well, I'm talking from experience.
Well, you've only done it 3 times, so...
No, but you know, I will justify it and I'll explain you why I justify it.
Yes, sir.
Especially historically, because perhaps now things might have changed, but not that much. Historically, you'll marry a girl who might be coming straight from school or who might not be schooled. You will go during the times of migrant labor. I'm a migrant in Gauteng. Leave a woman wherever, work. She must look after your kids. You are busy working wherever you are. You are doing your things wherever you are. She must raise your children. She must do this and that, sacrificing for you. Now comes the time for divorce. You must take everything. It's not fair.
It's not fair.
You must share. You must understand that what I've accumulated, I was accumulating with the support of this person.
Absolutely.
Her contribution.
So I think for me, if we had to take it from that, we wouldn't have this problem of saying, "Hey, but I built this triple story. Now I must share it with this person who was not working." Not taking into consideration that you were able to do all those things.
I've got
because she made
yes.
your environment
conducive.
I've got the triple story because I had the support.
Yes. And now you've got the tattoo. Absolutely. And you even forget that she even sacrificed for 9 months and more years waiting for you raising your tattoo.
While he was DJing, Radiso was attending all school meetings and you couldn't attend school committee meetings. And those are some of the things that I think, you know, you remember we spoke about customary marriage and now I'm writing a paper on how it could be used properly can guide and direct us. But yeah.
We are out of time. A final question, Prof. If your younger self could see you today, your work, your beliefs, your impact, what would surprise him the most?
What is surprising?
What would surprise your younger self about you right now?
I think I was a quieter version of myself.
Yeah.
Now I speak a lot, of course, within my friend's space, because I'm, like I said to you, I'm activated.
Yeah.
I don't speak a lot. I don't make friends easily.
So you're like an elevator.
Yeah.
If you press up, I'll go up.
I'll go up. I'm like that. So you wouldn't find me. I always tell people I can go from here to anywhere, sit in the hotel, go to the conference, go. I don't, socialize that easy until you will come and say, let's go. And once you link me to another person, then I can do that. So okay. I think that's one thing. But I really never thought that I'll be an academic.
Mm.
It was never part of my thinking ever. Of course, I used to think that I might be a pastor there and there, but it was something. I thought I'd be a pilot. I come from a business family. I said I'll be in business, So that's more or less was my orientation. I then surprised myself. Of course, I became a pastor, but eventually I never thought that I'd be. In fact, I became an academic by accident because my church said, if you want to be a pastor, you must go to university. That is our route. So I had to go to university. Now I fell in love with books by being in the university.
Absolutely. Prof, thank you for your time. Thank you for your mind. Thank you for your opinions. And I think most importantly, thank you for giving a damn about your people, about Africans, about our ways, of life, and about how we need to bring them back.
No, thank you very much for having hosted me, and I appreciate it because, when I watch your episodes through my brother Botsanye, I appreciate what you are trying to do, simplify it as possible without using big concepts, make it real in the life of, the impact and the effect that it has. And when I came here, I said, look, the little contribution that I can do
is
to share my views and so that they are able to go as far as to the bottom of where our people find themselves in the shacks, in Olivan, in Stueta, in Mshengu, in Atrishvide, and everywhere, so that the little that one would have learned, interacted with others by reading their views or through life experiences, should be able to be shared with our people elsewhere in the country. Thank you very much.
No, thanks, Prof. Thanks, Tato. For me, the key word is simplifying it. And that's what we said at the beginning. We've been on this show for over 2 years now. I think it's 2 years and a few months. And we have said from the very onset, we want to simplify the understanding of politics by people and how politics impacts in their lives. Governance issues, cultural issues. And it looks like more and more people, including academics, there's quite a number of professors who are followers of this platform, actually. And it shows that we are pressing or hitting the right buttons. But the most important thing is for the message to filter to the intended or the targeted mass.
You know what we do as a not as a mistake, because we write a lot of books, book chapters, articles. They are not read mostly by the lowest of the lowest. So through podcasts, you are able to share, or opinion pieces in newspapers, to share the little, but by simplifying it into our people. Thank
you. Where do we find you on social media? How do we contact you, sir?
Hey, I don't know if I'm that active in social media.
Or where do we read your papers?
But, I'm a Facebookist, because maybe I'm using Facebook just to be myself. I'm in tweet or X, but I'm not active because I like this. Facebook, it's like you are becoming yourself. You are.
Yes.
So I'm to Miss Nokwani in Facebook, but don't expect to see me in my seriousness. And I'm just there to be myself and to enjoy myself and to be, so that my children tomorrow are able to go into my Facebook page as my archive and see their dad for who he was, not really as an academic.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Prof, thank you very much. Botsanye, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tata. Thanks, Prof.
That was Professor Senukwane reminding us that dignity is not a luxury. It's the foundation. We are done with this episode of Wow, What a Week. We do this again next week. Coming to you from downtown Johannesburg, we're at Amped Studios, home to over 100 South African podcasts. We're part of the Africa Podcast Network. Email waw@africapodcastnetwork.com. Mm-hmm. Shout out Trevor and his crew at Pezulu Works for all of the cinematography, all of our social media by YBF. And most importantly, you for being a part of this. Remember to share, like, subscribe, and tell your mom that we are back on your favorite podcast platform. Till next week, have a wow week in spite of yourselves.